Welcome back to Unyielded, Thriving No Matter What. I'm your host, Bobby Kaler, and I'm so happy that you've joined us. As the creator and host of this podcast, it is critical to me to convey to you, our listeners, how much positive power you have inside of you right now, in this very moment. You have the power to change your life. And that could be changing it, like I had to back when I was 23, from a place of kind of being on a road to nowhere, kind of feeling hopeless and stuck, to being on a road to somewhere desirable, someplace good. It could also be changing your life from good to great. And it could also be changing your life from great to, I cannot believe how incredibly blessed and lucky I am to get to live this life. You have that power inside of you. And that is all you need to get started. The rest, you can learn along the way. I started this podcast as a way to bring stories of hope and triumph, as well as resources that will help you along that journey, whatever that might be, whatever your starting place is, or whatever your destination might be. My sincerest hope is that you find it valuable. So let's go. Here is this week's episode. My guest today is the director of a humanitarian organization, a popular speaker, and the author of two books. Her first book, Cry Until You Laugh, is about her and her husband's battle with cancer after being diagnosed just 4 months apart. Her second book, Love Is, chronicles her year-long quest to figure out the true meaning of love, a sometimes funny, sometimes scary, but always enlightening journey that led to life-changing discoveries. Her name is Kim Sorrell, and I think you're going to love getting to know her. Kim, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bobby. Thank you so much for having me. I have been looking forward to meeting you and spending time with you.
And likewise, as soon as we connected on Podmatch, I'm like, ooh, I can't wait for this conversation. So let's not keep the listeners, you know, waiting. I guess, can you just introduce yourself and let everyone know who you are?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm Kim Sorrell. I grew up in Grand Rapids, Michigan, so I'm a Midwestern girl with a lot of spunk, perhaps.
Yep.
And I was going to be the first woman president of the United States. I had my life laid out before me when I was in high school.
Wow, and that's pretty good.
I didn't think, and I'm younger than the current president, so I've got time.
You still have time.
Right. I wasn't sure that a marriage and kids really fit into the picture. But I did know two things, because I was very mature in high school, that if I ever were to meet a man, he had to have these two things. He had to be over 6 foot tall, because my very short mom married a short man, and I wanted to give my kids a shot. And he had to be good looking, because I wanted him to look good in my wedding picture.
Oh, there you
and
go.
Exactly. May of my senior year, this tall, dark, handsome man walked in a room, and I was immediately smitten. 10 days later, I asked him to marry me. We got married a little bit less than a year later.
Wow. You asked him to marry you?
I did. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That's so cool. Okay.
And then a couple years later, started having kids. I started my first business right out of high school, and I've been in business my whole life, different businesses, some that have lasted 30 plus years and some that have come and gone because I could sell them for a profit or whatever would happen. And I run a nonprofit organization. I'm a mom, a grandma, and life is good.
Wow. I'm curious, what was your first business?
My brothers and I were looking for a way to pay for college. And so we bought an old furniture manufacturing building that had been empty for years. So we bought it for a song and got tenants. So commercial industrial space, and was great. My oldest brother had paid for his undergrad and his veterinary school. And my other brother and I saw the potential in the business. And so we stuck with the business, and we ended up buying more buildings and more buildings and doing different things along the way, a golf course, some other things. But yeah, so that was the first, that was the start.
Wow. That's impressive to be, you know, right out of high school and do that. That's not a common path.
Yeah, probably not. Unless you're raised by my dad, then it's common.
Was your dad an entrepreneur?
He was an entrepreneur. He had a plastic bag manufacturing company that he started. And So because of that, we had a machine in our basement. And if we wanted to go to a movie or whatever, we had to go make bags to make money. So learned early, good work ethic. And he did a couple other things along the way too. He was an incredible businessman.
Wow, that's impressive. You know, and what a great, you might not have appreciated it at the time, but what a great life lesson or life skills to build, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure. I made my kids work in my businesses too. So
yeah,
what goes around comes around, I guess. But.
Good for you. It's funny that you mentioned that because my dad, I learned later in his life just how, like, he always had businesses. Like when he was in high school, of course he had paper routes when he was in grade school, but he decided, you know, back then he grew up in, you know, he was born in 33. You'd have to send your film off to have it developed and it could take like 2 weeks to come back. So he thought, well, I can have a dark room in his basement. So he set up a dark room and he started developing people's film for him. I'm like, what even? And he's like, well, it just seemed like it was a need because people wanted their pictures back sooner. I'm like, wow. And that was just one of the things he did. And I'm like, that is so incredible. You know,
yeah.
And here's a problem. How do I fix it? So now I know with your story, you had some unexpected twists and turns. I don't know a better way of saying it. Do you want to share with us a little bit about those?
Yeah. Well, a few years ago, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. Yeah. And 4 months later, my husband was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And he passed away 6 weeks after that.
Whoa.
Yeah, which, how crazy. Like, I've yet That's to crazy. Meet anybody with that particular story.
Yeah.
Where both people having cancer at the same time in a couple. Mm-hmm. And so it was a strange time and a difficult time, of course. And it made me question some things in life. Like, we're supposed to grow old together. I thought my life was laid out again, like, you know,
that's right.
Think that you know what your future holds. And here I was in my 40s and my life was no longer laid out. I had to figure out what I was going to do.
Yeah. And not only that, too. I mean, here you are, you're going through cancer treatment and now your support is, that must have been horrible for both of you and for your kids.
Yeah, my kids, it was, I just think it was so unbelievable in a way. And especially with pancreatic cancer, because there's just not a cure. You know, it's a really bad diagnosis, not one that you want. And and when he was diagnosed, we were told that he'd likely live a year. He was young and healthy and 6'3". I did the over 6 foot tall thing, 6 foot three and lean, 175 pounds and very active and ate good food, except he did think that donuts were the fifth food group. So I don't know what that means, but anyway, but he was a healthy guy.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, you know, wham.
Man. Yeah. It just had to blow up your world.
It did. It totally blew up my world. You know, first my own diagnosis, I mean, cancer in general in a family is going to blow up your world. Mm-hmm. And then, right. And then to have him diagnosed and he started having stomach issues a couple of weeks after I was diagnosed and went to the doctor. The doctor told him it was probably just nerves and take some
Rolaids
and went back 2 months later and was told the same thing. Went to a specialist 2 months after that and told the same thing. And I woke up one morning, I was a week out of a complete hysterectomy and they found bladder cancer when they did that. And so I was still recovering in bed and watching Grey's Anatomy reruns when I woke up and he was just in pain. I said, go to the ER. They'll run a test. They'll do something. You know, they're
Because it's not nerves at that point.
Yeah, no kidding. So so he did. Went to the ER and drove himself because I was still recovering and wearing, you know, elastic waist pants and whatever. And he called and said, I guess they're gonna keep me overnight. And I was like, keep you overnight? They don't keep anybody overnight. And this was a Friday. They're going to keep you overnight on the weekend? Like, what is that about? So I put on real people clothes and got in my car, and in my Vicodin-induced state, drove like a madwoman to the hospital. And yeah. I was almost there when my phone rang again. And he said, I guess there's a spot on my liver. I'm like, spot on your liver? I just started bawling. And I got to the hospital and parked and ran in holding all parts of my body, found out where he was, and he was behind a curtain, and I'm sobbing, and I whip the curtain back, and he's sitting on the edge of the bed like nothing is going on. And I'm sobbing, and he looked at me and he said, listen, I am not going to invite you out anymore if this is the way you're going to behave. And I said, listen, buddy, you are not allowed to be funny right now. But it took a couple of days to get a diagnosis, took a few days of biopsy and whatever he had to go through, poor guy. And
yeah.
And we got the diagnosis, and
God, I don't even know what to say. Like, I'm so sorry for all of that, you know? And now how long ago was that?
Almost 14 years.
Okay. So what happened next? Is that when you wrote your first book?
It is. Well, when I was diagnosed, I went to the bookstore and everything was either depressing or medical. And I thought, well, I want to know if I have choices. I want to know what it feels like. I want to know what going through it is. You know, I didn't know anybody, and I wanted to know. I wanted information. And so I started writing kind of as a way to update family and friends and go to the doctor tomorrow, surgery, you know, whatever. But it was so much more than that. And before I knew it, 5,000 people were reading the emails I was sending out. And so then I was still writing, of course, when my husband was diagnosed and then losing him. So I wrote for a little over a year. And that book is called Cry Until You Laugh, because you do. I mean, you have to laugh again. Like, I think so often we think it's dishonoring somehow, hurting the memory of somebody if we live again, if we get out of the deep grief. And I just think the opposite is true. I think it's honoring to live fully and live for both of you.
That is a really great point. Where do you think that belief comes from, you know, in you, that it's a form of honoring, not dishonoring?
Well, I think there are a few things. Like, people would ask me, why you, why you? And my response was always, well, why not you? Why not me? Why wouldn't it be? Because, you know, cancer is so random, right? Mm-hmm. It can affect anybody at any time. I don't think God is in heaven going, oh my gosh, you stole that pack of gum when you were in seventh grade. So when you're in your 40s, I'm giving you cancer, you know, whatever.
It doesn't work that way.
No, it doesn't work that way. And so, but that made me think. Mm-hmm. And then I realized that, you know, there are things that you have no control over, just none, right? Like, and you wouldn't pick cancer. I wouldn't pick losing my husband that I adored. You know, I wouldn't choose those things. But there are things that I do get to choose. And I get to choose to be happy. I get to choose how much joy there is in my life. I get to choose how full I want my life to be. And if my husband were here, we'd be living this grateful life together. Yeah. And so, you know, all the years that we were married for almost 29 years. Wow. And so all the years that we were together, I felt like if I just stayed in the grief, stayed down, and because it'd be easy to do. It can be easy to do. But if I just stayed there and didn't go tackle the world, that what were those 29 years? You know, why did we work so hard? Those 29, why did we have kids? Why did those 29 years happen?
Yeah.
So they happened for a reason.
You know, sometimes people call it coincidence or serendipity, but maybe, you know, maybe writing that book was, maybe that was meant to be. You know, so that it can help other people.
Right.
You
know? Right.
And one of the things you said there too, Kim, was how full do I want my life to be? You know, well, let me ask you this too. How long did it take before you felt like, okay, I can breathe again?
That's an interesting question. Right when my husband died, because we knew it was going to happen, right? Yeah. So we had this great 6 weeks together watching Cash Cab and, you know, whatever. We slept in the same bed every night. And we had a really great 6 weeks. It wasn't until the day he passed away that things went real south for him. Mercifully, it only lasted a couple hours of misery, and then he was gone. So some people linger, which is difficult, right? Mm-hmm. And so it was good, you know, sad for me, but great for him. And during that time, there would be times that I would just start crying.
Oh, yeah.
And he would hold me and he would say, "Don't cry for me. You're the one staying here. Don't cry for me."
Yeah.
And so I know he was at complete peace about it and had great faith and just was at peace. Hmm. And he was this incredible man. He got up at 5 o'clock every morning. And because of his faith, he was on the floor, you know, kneeling before God, praying, reading his Bible and a devotional book. And wow. He just was a great guy, you know, a great mm-hmm. friend to people. He was a good dad. He was a great husband and people liked him. You know, he was kind and generous. And I believe in heaven. And I think, mm-hmm. wow, you know, I was 47. He was 51. And so for him to go to heaven at 51 and never pay another bill, never feel pain again, never get sick again, you know,
yeah,
I just can't begrudge him. I know I had it better than most people have it their whole lives. And so we knew that he was going to go. We didn't know he was going to go that fast, but we knew he was going to go. And then I felt like I needed to be strong for my kids.
That's right.
And so put on a tough face and get through. And I was still dealing with stuff physically. Mm-hmm.
You were still recovering.
I had to get through my stuff. Yeah. So it was a different scenario when it came to, if the only thing would have had that was going on in life at the time would be losing my husband, that would be plenty. And mm-hmm. I think I would have handled it differently, but I had to make sure I was physically strong at the same time. And so when I was finally ready to go back to work physically, I could go back to work. I didn't know if I was going to go back to my businesses, but I had great staff, so I didn't need to. Mm-hmm. And I was running a nonprofit and had stepped down from that position because I wouldn't be able to do it. And I didn't know if I was going to go back there. And so I decided to take it slow to figure out this new life. And I took a job as part-time bookkeeper of a nonprofit organization that my dad and I had started 10 years before. And this man was running.
Wow.
And 12 days later, there was an earthquake in Haiti that killed 200,000 people. So I went from part-time bookkeeper to 24/7. And within 2 weeks, I was in Haiti. And then for the next several years, I was in Haiti for at least part of every month.
Wow. And what were you doing in Haiti?
Well, a lot of logistics. The organization that I now run, it's same organization. We're a partnering organization. We work with people in their own country that have a passion, a vision to do something to help people in their own country. And we walk alongside and help get there. So work with a lot of medical clinics and getting supplies that they need and equipment and schools, because it's hard to have school without pencils. And
there's
no Walmart, you know, it just doesn't exist. And so the average person makes less than $2 a day. And so it's a tough, tough place. So I worked with a lot of different organizations there.
Man, so much for your, you know, taking it slow.
Right. You know? Right. But you know, what's interesting, Bobby, is that I had never heard this before and it took me a minute to figure it out, but there's healing in service.
Absolutely.
You know, to get outside of yourself and serve other people, there's healing in that. You have a purpose, right?
Right.
Which is always important in anybody's life, figuring out that you do have a purpose and that it can be for good.
That's
right. But I think the world, the universe has this incredible way of working that you can't outgive. You can't outgive. Like you go and serve or you, in the local soup kitchen. It doesn't even matter where or what kind of service you're giving, but you go and do it thinking you're giving, but what you receive is so much bigger than what you give.
Yeah.
No matter how much you try to give, you just can't outgive what you receive.
Mm-mm. No. And it's interesting too, because it doesn't have to be even in big ways. I think that's something that people miss too. Like I was sharing that it was, you know, minus 16 today because it's pretty cold. We're recording this on January 31st and we get a lot of tourists in our neighborhood. And, you know, we live at 9,000 feet. They come up here. They don't have snow tires. We get a big snow. I don't care if you have all weather tires. I don't care if you have an SUV. it's hard to drive up here because you have to go up and all this kind of, you know, all the up and down and everything. So it's very common. We'll be out for a walk with our dogs and hear someone stuck in a driveway or they're stuck on the road. And, you know, we make a habit of, you know, hey, we'll be right back. We'll go get our shovels. We've got a tow strap so we can, we can tow them out of the snowbank. And it was funny. We were out yesterday and someone stopped and they're like, it's not even 9 o'clock and you're already helping somebody. And it's like, but you know what? They're on vacation. Who brings a snow shovel with you? You don't have one in your car.
I don't know if TSA allows it.
They probably wouldn't, So I totally agree. And then you just feel good. It's like, hey, I helped somebody, right? They're on vacation. Do they want to spend their whole day calling a tow truck when we can just get a shovel and help them? No. So, all right, let's talk about the second book, The Love Is. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. So losing my husband made me question what love really is. Because there seems to be this mystery around love, right? Like, you know, Nicholas Sparks defines it one way and Ed Sheeran and, you know, whatever, but that's whatever
right.
love that is, you know, and there are so many things about love that were taught wrong. You know, we learn love from our parents or whoever mentors in our lives, and not everything done in the name of love is love. Not everything said in the name of love is love. And I think you're supposed to love everybody, but what does that mean? You know, what does love even mean? And so
good question.
I decided I would take a year and dedicate it to figuring out, searching for the true meaning of love. So I took this 2,000-year-old poem, love is patient, love is kind, does not envy, does not boast, et cetera. And I decided I would take one word a month and figure out, well, what is love that is patient? What is love that is kind? And the first thing I figured out is that there are 14 is's and isn'ts of love in the poem. So it took me a little longer than a year, one a month.
Didn't line up perfectly.
Not perfectly, but it blew my mind. The things that I found out about love, things that I've never heard before, and things that are life-changing, definitely changed my life and my perspective in every way. And I want to share that with the world, you know, the things that I learned about love, what love really is.
So what were some of the things that really stood out to you that you learned?
Well, you know, there's like an easy one. There's a hard one. Well, nothing was easy, I guess, actually, now that I say that, but right from the very start, love is patient. I thought, well, I know what that means. You know, we know what patience is, you know, I'm not mad because we're walking out the door and our three-year-old can't find his shoes, you know, or we're stuck in a traffic jam. We're not honking our horn, right? We're being patient. But you put love is or love is not in front of any word and it changes the definition. So love is patient. You love the person you're with in love that is patient in a way that you recognize that this is the most important moment of your life. What's in the past is in the past, and what's in the future is yet to come. This is the moment. This moment will come and go with or without you, whether you're there or you're not there. And to show love, you are fully there. And I have to tell you, I stunk at this. I was terrible. it was nothing for me to be in conversation with somebody, be thinking about a meeting I had later, who had to get to soccer practice, what I needed to get from the grocery store. But think that I'm fully engaged. Think that I'm hearing everything.
Yep.
But I don't have that superpower. I don't think anybody does. So this took me so much practice to really focus. But when I did, it changed everything. I heard things I never would have heard.
Yeah.
I heard things in a whole different way. Instead of making assumptions about what somebody was going to say or having my rebuttal ready, right? But to really listen. Really listen, like it's a game changer.
Yeah.
And that's love that is patient.
And you're totally right. Because people say that all the time. Oh, I'm a great multitasker. I can listen while I'm typing. I can listen while I'm doing this. No. I mean, the studies in neuroscience are really, really conclusive. Our brains are not wired to do that. And what's really interesting is the studies have shown the more you think you are good at it, the worse you really are. Because you got blinders on. You can't. You know?
No, you can't. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So how did you go about learning that lesson?
Well, it's funny because every single month, it took me till the end of the month. You know, I started out the month, you know, looking for it. Love is kind, love is kind, love is kind, you know, and just trying to find it everywhere I'm looking. And then some big thing, I'd get knocked over the head with something that would go, make me go, oh, Now I get it. And in that particular month, I was working on getting a container out of customs in Haiti, which is a nightmare. And this happened to be more of a nightmare than the usual nightmare. And so it led me to discovering love that is patient is. But every month, there's some crazy, I was chased by a motorcycle gang. I slept outside with tarantulas and snakes and whatever. I got lost on a mile high mountain with in the dark with a medical student. So that was lovely. I'm sure her parents will trust me to take her away again. So all these crazy things happened that led me to whatever it was I was working on that month.
Yeah. Wow. So, okay. So tell me a little bit about your process. So it's month one or month two, whatever. And now you've chosen your word for that month, you know, love is you've chosen it. Okay. And then you were like, just how is it going to show up? How is it going to manifest? What did that look like? I'm so curious.
Yeah. I mean, I just kept it in my head and one month led to the next, right? So after I learned what love is patient is, I was practicing it while I was working on love is kind and et cetera, right? They carried over. The truths carried over. And so I would just think about it all the time and think, okay, love is kind. You know, wherever I went, you know, is it going to reveal itself? Is it just being kind, saying kind things like I thought it was? You know, so in my book, Love Is, I start out each chapter with what I think it's going to be because they all seem so obvious, right? Yeah. Patient, kind, you don't envy, you don't boast, you know, they all seem so obvious. But then the real meaning was totally different than what I expected. So then I write the story about what happens in Haiti that leads me to the truth about love. Yeah.
So now that you've experienced it, you lived it, you know, you wrote the book, how would you answer what love is?
Well, I would say, you know, each of the 14 is and isn'ts are unique among themselves, but there's this umbrella over it all. Mm-hmm. And I would say, first of all, love is not a couple of things. Like love is not an emotion or a feeling. You know, fear is an emotion. You watch a scary movie that night, you hear every creak, every door, right? Every bump in the night, but you don't live in that. You don't live in fear. And that's an emotion. Love is not an emotion. Love is something you are. It's walking, talking, living, breathing, doing. It's something you are to other people. You live in love. You live in that. That
it's
is
a verb,
a constant, right? And so understanding that, you know, kind of is the first thing, but love is not a transaction, you know, so often we're told, right? We're told that love's a two-way street. It's not, it's one way, you know, you go the other way, you're going to crash. You know, it is a one-way street. If I give you money and you give me a pair of jeans, that's a transaction. If that's I give you love to get love, that's a transaction. Love is not a transaction. We have no control over the love that comes back to us. Zero control. We only have control of ourselves. We don't control people. You bring a baby home from the hospital and you have total control. You decide when the baby eats, when the baby sleeps, when you bathe the baby. And then 6, 7, 8 months later, your Tupperware is all over your kitchen floor and pots and pans are banging everywhere. And you realize you have lost all control and you will never get it back again. We do not control other people. So if you give
we
love.
Try. If we try. Too many times we try. And that brings how much pain and agony.
Exactly. That's the thing. I mean, if your expectations are not going to be met. No. You know, love is up to you, period. Love is a one-way street.
That's really good.
Well, and love allows you and allows others to be exactly who they believe they're created to be. So with love, there's no judgment, there's no condemnation, there's no racism, there's no ageism, there's no any other kind of ism. It is recognizing that we're all unique. We're all different. It's okay if somebody has a different opinion.
That's
again,
right.
You don't control it. It's okay. You know, it'd be boring. My gosh, if the world was full of me, I'd be bored out of my mind, you know, drive myself crazy probably or something. It's great that we're different and that we share different opinions. Yeah. And when you love, you have conversations instead of confrontations. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it can be so easy to say, well, I love everybody, but those darn Democrats, or I love everybody, but those Republicans, right? Then you don't love everybody. And love doesn't have labels like that.
No, you know, it doesn't.
Bob, I'm Kim. You know, we put the labels on. Love mm-hmm. doesn't put any labels on. We're all equal. We're all walking on the same earth.
Yeah.
And none of us have walked in the exact same pair of shoes.
I keep thinking about what you said, you know, there's no control over when you love, there's no control over what comes back, right? And it's not about controlling the other person. And when you're talking about, you know, like, well, I love everybody except those people, you know, or somehow, you know, they hold a different view than I do. I've even heard people say, well, if you vote for X candidate, then that means you can't love me. And it's like, I don't even understand this. I don't even understand how we're getting to this.
Yeah, because the relationships that you have are with a person.
Yeah.
For who they are, not who they vote for. Right?
That's right. Like, or who you want them to be.
Right. Not who you want them to be, but you love somebody for who they are. And so, you know, you get married because you're in love. You love mm-hmm. this person. You want to marry them. You want to spend the rest of your life with them. You don't take away your love because he leaves his dirty underwear on the bathroom floor. Right?
You didn't roll the toothpaste. You did not squeeze the toothpaste tube in the right direction. So all bets are off.
Right. You're out of here. You're just out of here. Well, that's something he did. Those are, you know, things that people do. That's not who they are. Mm-hmm. And if we get back to the essence of loving people for who they are, not what they do and who they vote for.
That's right.
Then that's love.
That's right. The other thing too, I was thinking about this when something you said triggered it. I don't know where I read this, but you know, you said, you know, you marry someone because of who they are, right? And then, but so many people, I don't know where I read this. I wish I could remember. Doesn't matter. They said that one of the first things that happens when you marry someone is, and it's like, okay, no, I'm going to change you into what I want you to be. What happened? Like, this was an amazing person. At least that's why I think you'd want to marry someone. So I wonder if that's a hard space for people to hold, you know, not controlling and not being able to change.
I think it can be, you know, I think it's like when you get a new babysitter, you kind of push the limits. You know, see how far you can push them. And I think early in a marriage, you can behave that way without even realizing it. Like, how far can I push this guy before he walks out the door? You mm-hmm. know, or I drive him completely mad. You know, what can I get away with? You're kind of establishing your territory and deciding who's going to be in charge of what. You know, there's all these things that happen when you're early in your marriage that it'd be so great if you could start your marriage like 10 years in, 25 years in, something, so that mm-hmm. you have that much maturity in a relationship. So you're going, who cares? He missed the hamper, you know, big deal, whatever. I can live with that because he also mows the lawn. I don't know, but you deal in a different way. And what's important to you in the first couple of years of marriage compared to what's important to you later on, it's just not the same changes. Mm-mm.
No. And really, if you miss the hamper, is it that big of a deal?
Right.
Wow.
It's forgivable. I think it should be forgivable.
Yeah. So, okay. So what are your like final thoughts? Having written the book on Love Is, like, what would you want people to know about that?
Well, first of all, that it's great if you're open to a new definition of love.
Mm.
If you can look and say, maybe I don't know everything there is about love, or maybe some of the things that I think are love maybe aren't love, and then figure out the real definition of love. And when you live in it, when you love everybody and let everybody be who they're created to be and let yourself be who you're created to be and love yourself, it's complete freedom because mm-hmm. you're no longer trying to fix people. You're not criticizing them for the things they're doing because they're doing it. They get to do whatever, people get to do whatever they want.
That's right.
You have no control again, right? So it's so freeing to just love people, to just love. It's all you got to do.
Yeah. I was reading someone, I think it was Wayne Dyer, Dr. Wayne Dyer, and he was saying like, when we come from a fear-based mindset, that's when we're trying to control because the fear is what's driving the control. Do you kind of agree with that?
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Because you think somehow what they do is going to affect you, but mm-hmm. you get to react however you want to react.
Yeah.
Right. Like
that's your choice.
It's your choice. So two people can be in the same traffic jam. One guy, his blood pressure is going up. He's screaming out the window, honking the horn, right? And all upset. And the next guy is in his car going, oh, Bobby's got a podcast. I'm stuck. I might as well listen, you know, and
that's show right.
Like, nothing I can do about it. So you get to pick how you react.
Yeah.
And
you know, okay. That is such a great example. This was, oh my gosh, Kim, this was years ago. This was in the late 90s. And I lived about an hour from Chicago and I had a job in Chicago. And usually I took the train in, but this one day, for some reason, I decided, let's drive. That'll be fun in rush hour traffic. I think I needed the car for some reason. And it was one of those things, I was still way outside the city and it was just stopped, you know? And I'm like, oh my goodness, I'm going to be late. I'm going to be late. And this was before cell phones really. And I could see people, you know, is like in the other cars and some people like, you know, honking their horns and yelling at everybody. And then I looked at my rear view mirror and I could see the guy behind me. He must've had on like classical music or something. Cause I could just see him like he's conducting and he's like singing. And it's like, oh my God, that's the reaction I want to have to this. Right. I have a radio. I love singing country music songs. And the only place I should sing is in the car with the windows up when no one's around. Like, perfect time. But I'm like, that is such a great illustration, right? Of we get to choose that response. And that guy behind me, he was having a good time. He had a big smile on his face. I bet you his blood pressure did not raise a little bit, not even a little bit.
I bet you're right. And I bet he had a better day.
A better day. You know, years ago, I read this book on when we like being stuck in traffic. And when we get upset by that, it raises our blood pressure very definitely. It activates all these kind of stress hormones and everything. And we feel that effect for something like 4 hours after the event is over. So think about it. If you're commuting twice a day and you get upset both ways, think what you're putting your body through.
Yeah.
It's not the drive time.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Not good. Yeah.
Wow. That just triggered that memory. Thank you for that. So how can people learn more about you, learn more about your book and all that kind of stuff?
Well, my website is kimsorrell.com, but my last name is a little obnoxious. I'm the only Kim Sorrell spelled my way in the entire world because it has way too many letters. There are two R's, two E's, two L's. S-O-R-R-E-L-L-E, kimsorrell.com. But Love is the name of my book. It's a dark blue cover and big white Love Is. And if you Google Love Is, chances are I'm going to come up. And so I'm pretty easy to find and love to connect with people. So please reach out. I've got a free 14-day love challenge on my website. And if you join that for free, I will send you for free a WWLD, what would love do wristband. Because if you can answer anything that way, you're going to be doing the right thing.
I love that. And tell me just a little bit about the challenge. I'm intrigued.
Yeah. So each day there's just a little something to read to make you think about that part of love each day. So it's just a little something to try to practice each day. So it's an easy thing to do, but makes you think.
Yeah. And I love the little wristband. What would love do? You know, because if you ask yourself that question, how would that change your outcomes? And how you feel during the course of the day.
Right. Right.
Nice.
Yep.
Well, thank you so much for being here and for sharing and for writing the books, right? And being able to share this with the world.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for having me. I so appreciate it. You're awesome. So thank you. Everybody should have you on the top of their podcast list.
Thank you, Kim. I appreciate that. I hope that you enjoyed that conversation. I had a few different insights and takeaways. Here they are, and in no particular order. So number one, the whole notion around crying until you laugh, and that when you go through pain and hardship, it's okay to laugh again. And I love how Kim said it. It's really like an honoring of the person who you've lost. Number two, there are things that you have absolutely no control over, and you would never, ever choose them. But even in those moments, there are still things that you get to choose. Number three, I love the question that she asked herself. How full do I want my life to be? Number four, what's in the past is in the past. What's in the future is yet to come. This is the moment. The present moment is the moment. And this moment is going to come and go whether you're there or not. And to show love, you really need to be fully there. I absolutely loved that part of the conversation when Kim said that. Number five. This one is kind of a little a myth buster in a way. But that the common belief that love is a two-way street actually turns love into a transaction. Number six, love allows you and it allows others to be exactly who they believe they were created to be. Number seven, and if you've listened to the podcast at all, you're not going to be surprised about this, but I loved it when Kim said, you get to pick your reaction. Even if it's something as mundane as being stuck in traffic, you get to choose your reaction. That's a powerful notion. That comes down to recognizing where we have choice. And choice is one of the most empowering things that we can embrace. And finally, number eight, I absolutely love the wristband that poses the question, what would love do? Think about how that could change things if we put our decisions and our choices and our even our challenges through that lens, through that question of what would love do? How would love respond in this moment? Again, I hope you loved that conversation, that you'll go to Kim's website, check out her content and her books. And I just want to thank you all for tuning in and for listening and for supporting the podcast as much as you have. I'm grateful beyond words for that. You are the reason that we do this. This is to share stories and share insights and inspiration that will help all of you thrive no matter what.